No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in if you have a question at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions in. And first, let me say hello to my co-host, Maria. Maria, hello, and thanks for being with us again today.
Thank you, Michael. It's always great to be here.
And we have just such a special guest tonight, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend. She was the first female lieutenant governor of the state of Maryland, a honors graduate of Harvard University with 14 honorary degrees. We could go on and on and on and on about her, but then we wouldn't have time to do the show. I think most people know who you are, Lieutenant Governor, and thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Well, it's my pleasure. I'm delighted to talk with you. And as you probably know, today is the 53rd anniversary of my father's death. So I was out at Arlington Cemetery today with a number of friends paying tribute to my father. And we also visited the graves of my uncle, John Kennedy, and Ted Kennedy, and the ceremonial cross for my uncle Joe Kennedy, who died in World War II. So it's a very special day for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And we certainly appreciate you being here on such a special day. I have to tell you that when I've been involved in the last 11 Democratic conventions, and I remember very distinctly walking down the street in Los Angeles in 2000, and stopping in front of the Ambassador Hotel, which was abandoned, and I believe they were tearing it down at the time, and thinking about that horrible day in 1968.
Well, you know, what I have to say, you know, there was a person that was shot at the same time as my father, but happily he survived. He used to work for the UAW, and then he worked with Cesar Chavez at the Farm Workers Union. His name is Paul Schrade, and he dedicated himself to transforming that hotel into a school, and it's now the Robert Kennedy Community School. And it's a terrific, if you ever go back to Los Angeles, you can visit that school, and it's a wonderful, wonderful education center for children in the neighborhood. And it's just a fabulous, fabulous place. It's new, it's exciting, and it's a really a tribute to my father, and there are wonderful murals on the wall of him with Cesar Chavez, because it's a mostly Hispanic neighborhood, and it's a wonderful place rather than being just a sad place. It's a place of rebirth.
Well, what a great tribute to his memory.
Really, to Paul Schrade. I have to say it's a real tribute to Paul Schrade, who, also suffered the loss of his friend and was hurt himself. But he's still with us, and he really worked hard to create that school.
Well, I think we all remember, those of us that are old enough, all remember that terrible, terrible summer with his passing, with his murder, with the murder of Dr. King, with the contentious Democratic convention. We all remember how the cities burned in 1968. And I think, Lieutenant Governor, many of us are fearful that we're headed down that same path again. Do you think we are?
Well, I think really if you know, because I've been reading some of, there's a new book out about my father and civil rights called Justice Rising. So I'm reading that book and I'm thinking about the summer of 68. And 60, we're actually just not 68, 66, 67. And there were really terrible riots at that time. If we're the same age. We were younger, a lot younger then. But, they were burning the cities and many people were killed. They were in the 20s and the 30s in each of these cities. And we're not seeing that in those kind of numbers in our cities today. So we really are not seeing the killings and the deaths and the burnings and the destruction, not on the scale that we saw it those many years ago. And that's not to say that it won't come from the right wing, which is, as the Justice Department has said, from the white right-wing nationalists who are now a greater threat to us than the, that they said, Al-Qaeda or ISIS. So there is real danger there, and that's what we have to watch out for. But at the moment, we haven't seen the same destruction that we saw so many years ago.
Well, and some of our listeners might not know, if they aren't old enough.
That's true. Maybe you want to actually, can you call me Kathleen? After all,
well, that was
I've been Lieutenant Governor for like 22 decades. I'm kind of Kathleen nowadays. Thank you.
See. But you're the eldest of Ethel and Robert Kennedy's 11 children and the eldest grandchild of Rose and Joseph Kennedy. What was that like to be the eldest of that many children?
It meant that I was very bossy, and I gave my opinion lots of times, and I was accustomed to not being listened to. How's that? It's a good practice for politics.
I'm sure you were a default parent too, right?
In many ways, I was.
I mean, I'm the eldest of four.
So the oldest, if you're a girl and you're the oldest, you take on enormous sense of responsibility and a sense that you have to be good and do the right thing. You might be Catholic, Marie. I don't know.
Yes, I am.
Yes. So, I went to parochial school in Washington, actually, at Our Lady of Victory on MacArthur Boulevard.
Get out of here. That's down the street from me, Our Lady of Victory.
Exactly. I know. Yeah. Well, Our Lady. You know MacArthur Boulevard. I don't know if you know it.
Yes, very well. And you know what? I had an older sister, and she was the boss, too. And I've always said the greatest thing you can be in life is a 12-year-old boy. Because nobody expects anything of you. We expect things of a 12-year-old girl, right? We expect her to be able to have a little responsibility. But we sit around when we see a 12-year-old boy do something stupid, we all sit around and go, oh, he's a boy,
Well, I was babysitting my siblings before I was 10 years old. I was babysitting my siblings before I was 10 years old. As the eldest, and granted, my folks were in the neighborhood, but nevertheless, you would never do that. I never would have done that with my children, let alone now.
Mm-hmm. It's a different time. Totally different situation. And then, of course, in those days, if you were in parochial school, at Our Lady of Victory, we had 45 kids in our class and one nun. But you had the threat of heaven and hell, so it was pretty okay. Heaven or hell, purgatory, which was not supposed to be very pleasant either. So anyway, that was a very different time.
Well,
and the discipline that required, because I was in a class of 50. There was 50 per.
Oh, you
class.
Had 50 kids in your class. Where were you? Yes. Where did you go to school? What city?
Our Lady of Lourdes in the San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles, and there was 50 in per class, and there were two classes per grade. So there were 800 kids in first through eighth grade at the school, and I never recall anybody getting in trouble at all, ever.
Isn't that a riot, don't you think?
Yeah,
that's because you had you had nuns.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
I remember, I've always said, you know, as a refugee from Catholic education, I said, you know, the nuns that taught me, I'm sure all checked, I don't like children on the employment application. And then they trussed them up in 50 pounds worth of wool clothes, right, and put them in a classroom. They were tough. I know nuns that could make a Marine cry. Absolutely.
I will tell you one interesting thing about my childhood, which was just sort of, was that my father at that time was, when I was at parochial school and younger, when other mothers were taking their children to the playground, my mother would take us to, my brothers and me, to the Senate Racket Committee hearings.
Yeah.
And so my first words were almost, I refuse to answer that question on the grounds that they tend to incriminate me.
There you go.
Let me tell you why I'm telling you that story is because, so that's what I often went to the Racket Committee hearings on the Capitol. You know, we'd drive down. I lived in Georgia, you know, I grew up in Georgetown, which I don't know if you knew that, but that is actually where my first 5 years of life were. And then went to Our Lady of Victory. And then when I was at Our Lady of Victory, the thugs wanted to threaten my father, so they threatened to throw acid in our eyes. And so we were not allowed to leave for about 6 months when I was there. We weren't allowed to leave the school. I used to, for a long time, I would play with my friends and we'd, you know, play around and walk over to sort of where Georgetown Hospital was. You know, there's a park near there, which I'm sure, on Reservoir Road.
Yep.
You know where I'm?
Still there.
Still there. So it's very nice. Anyway, we'd walk there, we'd play in the park. But for a while, I wasn't allowed to do it because the thugs threatened to throw acid in our eyes, and we'd had to stay up in the principal's office, in the nun's office, just wait till my mother would come and pick us up, and we'd watch her drive up in the car, and when she arrived, we were allowed to go down and see her. But there was a period of time we couldn't go outside and play with our friends.
Wow.
It was really tough. I'm just explaining that there was a seriousness about our childhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. Something that the rest of us, you know, I grew up in North New Jersey as a young child, amongst in the Italian neighborhood. So a lot of those guys that were taken to Fifth were probably my neighbors, but we were very safe in our neighborhood. Because it was very insular.
I shouldn't make large generalizations, but when I went to college in Boston, and the safest neighborhoods were known to be the North End, which was the Italian neighborhood.
Yeah. Yeah, they weren't them. You didn't want to be in my neighborhood if you were a person of color. I mean, it was horrible in that sense. We were very segregated and stuff, but it was very insular. Let me ask you, you've written, we have to address this question. You recently wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post because there are Republicans, unfortunately, in the United States Senate that are using statements that your father made about the 23rd Amendment almost 50 years ago to say that he supported the idea that D.C. could only achieve equality through a constitutional amendment. And you wrote that an article said that wasn't true. Obviously, he was a great egalitarian, and he believed in civil rights for everybody. So it's really a silly statement for them to make, is it not?
Well, actually, yeah. So he was, the 23rd Amendment, as you know, gave Washington, D.C. three electors, and he was very much in favor of that. Then there was testimony in 1963 when there was the issue, which was after the 23rd Amendment was passed and enacted, and when Washington, D.C. did have its 23 electors, as to whether and how D.C. could get two senators. And how would that? So you wouldn't have to be a shadow senator, but could be a real senator. And right. The question, it was a wide-ranging discussion. And during that discussion, my father was asked, do you need a constitutional amendment? And he said, because the Solicitor General and others thought you may need a constitutional amendment. And so that's what he was quoted as saying. But he did say during that time, I hope there is another way. Because he said the most important thing is a government by the people, that represents the people. And that part of his testimony was not quoted by the Republicans. And the point is, he was very clear in that testimony that day that you really needed government of the people, for the people, and representing the people. And he absolutely wanted that Washington would have its representations and have senators that could be in the Congress of the United States. So that, and that all of that was not at all quoted. And then when the Justice Department sent a memo into the Congress, again, it wasn't absolutely certain that you needed a constitutional amendment. It said it was arguable that you needed one. So the whole point of this is that he was going along with what was then many people believed you needed a constitutional amendment. But now, as you know, many constitutional scholars have come to a different conclusion. Obviously, in the 18th, when Virginia took their part of Washington back, you didn't do it through a constitutional amendment. Right. It went. So it really depends on the politics of the time. So if those Republicans wanted to allow Washington to be a real city with, you know, voters, they could do it. And the truth is, they don't want Washington to have any independence. They are allowing people from Kansas and Nebraska and Iowa to decide whether Washington can have laws on, as I pointed out in that column, marijuana, abortion, labor laws. They just think they're just treating us like a colony. It's absurd and wrong and anti-democratic, as I pointed out in the article. And they don't even, and of course they don't want us to be a state because they don't want us to have two Democratic senators. But it goes beyond that. They don't even want us to have self-determination. So it's outrageous what they're doing.
And I mentioned in the article, too, about that you have respect, or you admire, I guess is what you said, about Senator Joe Manchin, who used or misused or took out of context.
Well, what I did after I read the article that was about to I called the Joe Manchin's office, and I called the Republican offices, because I wanted to be able to say to them, it is possible that your staff just didn't do a good research job. I wanted to give them a way out and say, and as I know, when I was in office, I didn't do all the research. I relied on my staff a lot of the time to say, sometimes they just look briefly through the testimony and not find everything. So I just wanted to say to them, you may not have seen what I saw. For instance, I was going to quote one congressman, and it wasn't put in the article. His name wasn't included. But when I talked to him, and the one congressman I actually talked to was not put in the article, and he was actually quoting the 23rd Amendment. He wasn't quoting the testimony from November 20th, 1963. So it was, as I was allowing it to be, not quoting the right testimony even, not quoting actually what my father was actually saying. So they had actually missed what my father had said, as I was giving them the benefit of the doubt.
Well, and you know what? I mean, obviously, when you've got members of Congress saying that you don't have an airport or enough car dealerships in order to become a state, they're really not looking for the truth. They're looking for excuses. And we see that over and over again. It really does come down to two Democrats in the Senate, which it always has come down to. You know, when Alaska and Hawaii, we use this example all the time, when they were seeking statehood, they said Alaska would never elect a Republican and Hawaii would never elect a Democrat. And obviously, we know, you know, time has shown us that that's certainly not true. But it's always been a partisan. It's always been a partisan battle, and it still is. You know, right. One thing I'd like to ask.
I mean, the best answer would be, if you knew Puerto Rico would go.
Right.
Republican, but you know, mm-hmm. And sometimes Puerto Rico is Republican, but right. Sometimes it's Democratic. So it's a challenge.
And you know what? They're more amenable. They seem more amenable to Puerto Rico because it does go Republican time to time, and because their Puerto Rican statehood is in the Republican platform. D.C. statehood has never been there. So they seem to show a little more deference to the Puerto Ricans. But let me ask you, I don't know that you can answer this question, but, you know, we grew up, we know that political rhetoric has unfortunately lately been the driver of violence. But I grew up on the political rhetoric of your uncle who said, you know, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And who often quoted Luke saying, to whom much is given, much is expected. How did we go from that to, it seems to me that now America is asking not what they can do for the country, but what's in it for me?
Right.
How do you think that rhetoric, you know, what is driving that? Yeah. You know,
well, I think it really changed under Ronald Reagan. And I think it particularly changed. I'm sure you've studied about the Powell memo. Justice Powell, who was at the chamber, got the Chamber of Commerce to say, we're losing the battle of ideas. And we really have to fight the battle of ideas, and said we're going to start funding think tanks and throughout the country and funding universities and talk about the importance of private enterprise and the importance of making money. And that's what we're going to do. And the importance of deregulation and ideas really shape people's sense of what's going on. I mean, we've seen that, for instance, with COVID, where people are on their deathbed and they don't think they have COVID because they've been told that COVID doesn't really exist. Yeah. I mean, so it shows you that you can have an experience, but if you have an idea, that's a bad word. I don't like to use it at the moment. That dominates your own experience. If you have an idea. And so they were very smart, the Republicans, or the, you know, the people who are interested in money. And that's really what happened, I believe. So that's what I think happened. And I, you know, I just went to the grave site, as I told you earlier today, and I saw President Kennedy's words. And that was not only that he said about ask not what you can do for your country. He said, you know, we are in the time of maximum danger for freedom. And I don't shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. And yeah. I just was thinking of how people so much are shrinking from responsibility, not taking responsibility for the lack of health care for some and the lack of, you know, real job, good wages for jobs. On the other hand, I saw the New York Times this morning, and I'm sure you saw it too, where for a moment it looks like the workers are getting a leg up. I was in Rehoboth. I'm sure each of you, or at least you, Michael, have been to Rehoboth a number of times. And I went to Rehoboth last weekend, and I went to the grocery store, and they're giving $1,000 hiring bonuses. Did you see that?
Wow. No. No, but I've heard of, you know, I went to the Outer Banks last weekend, and the probably one of the more popular restaurants in Duck, North Carolina, is closed on the weekends because they can't get help. I mean, that just shocked me. I thought, this has got to be their biggest time, right, on the weekends, but they're not open on Saturday and Sunday because they can't get people to work. They can't find enough people to work. And when I, as you probably know, growing up in this area, you know, we would kill to get a job at the beach in the summer. Everybody wanted to work in Ocean City or Rehoboth or someplace like that. And you could barely make enough money to survive because of the rents and stuff. You had to live in a house with like 23 other people and one bathroom. Right. And you know, but they can't get people. Yeah, it just absolutely amazes me. Can I talk to you for a second? Because this is a pet. I don't know if I want to call it pet peeve or what, but I worked for Jimmy Carter. That's how I started out in
Good
politics.
For you. Good for you.
And I don't know where we lost God. You've written a book called How Today's Churches are mixing God with politics and losing their way. You know, when I was at the DNC, I was a vestry member of my church. I was a youth group leader in my church. I know that Maria was raised a Catholic. I was raised a Catholic. And I don't understand where the Democratic Party lost God. Why and how, as a good Christian, you can believe some of the stuff that's being put out there these days, you know, that God believes in AR-15 rifles and discriminating against people that aren't the same color you are. I don't know where these ideas come from. So let's talk about your book a little.
Oh, thank you. I'd love to. Thank you. Very
kind. And it must seem, because you published that like in 2007, I think.
Yeah, a long time ago.
Prescient it is now.
Thank you. Thank you. That's very kind of you to say. Yes, well, the book, I have to tell you, criticizes both the left and the right. It criticizes the right for shrinking God to three issues, you know, abortion, same-sex marriage, and stem cell research. And it criticizes the left for forgetting God. So, we can talk about either side if you want. We can talk about the left if you want, because obviously, I have to tell you, I first wrote about this in 1980 after I worked on my uncle Teddy's campaign. And I was stunned by how little the left was interested in religious values during that campaign. Mm-hmm. And I wrote an article for the New York Times about it. And then I wrote a much larger article about it for the Washington Monthly. And basically, to give you a little background about me, if you don't mind, I majored in American history and literature. And I had seen in that major that every progressive change in American history, from the American Revolution, which was based on the First Great Awakening, where people believed that God lay within each of us so that they can say we do not have to believe in the king, but within our own God, that God could speak to us so we don't have to really pay attention to King George, to the Second Great Awakening, where they said, you know, God preached to African Americans, they were called, you know, blacks then, which led to the abolitionist movement. And then later on to the women's movement in the 19th century, where there was, I kid you not, a women's Bible. There, all the, you know, the abolitionists believed in God. And then the the union movement in the 19th century and the early 20th century was very much based on, in fact, Rerum Novarum, which came out of the Catholic Church, very strong religious base to it. So all of that had a very strong religious base. So it appealed to many Americans, or could appeal to many Americans, because 85% of Americans at that point said they go to church. Now, only 50% do. It's even fewer now, but at least that's what they think they do. So It was a very broad-based movement and a broad-based appeal. And you know what happened? So I'll tell you what happened and what changed it, which of course
I
do.
Yeah, please.
Thank you. I mean, you've got me on my soapbox, so ask me about my book.
I want you.
Yeah, and your passion is palpable.
Can you tell?
Absolutely, totally, and love it.
Yeah, thank you. It's totally palpable. So anyway, so what happened is that during the Civil Rights Movement, you had Martin Luther King, who was obviously a preacher, John Lewis, Reverend Ralph Abernathy, very strong religious grounding. And they were, as you know, believed in nonviolence, had a very, you know, Christian take on what we should do to convince white America that the discrimination was wrong. And in fact, I think they would believe what they did was very effective, because they had the pictures on television of African-Americans and white people, but not many, really African-Americans, walking peacefully, being beaten up. And people were outraged at what happened in Selma or Montgomery, and because they saw just the horror of what was going on. And that helped, of course, along with Lyndon Johnson and my uncle's death and my father working very hard on this, getting the civil rights legislation passed and getting the voting rights legislation passed in 64 and 65. But there was another group, the totally more secular group, the Black Power group, that didn't like the religious. They thought they were too passive. So they were not religiously based. And out of the Black Power group came 20th century women's movement and the 20th century gay rights movement. So they did not have a religious grounding, because they didn't come out of, they didn't stick with the Martin Luther King side of religion. They came out of the sort of the Black Power movement. Now, and therefore they didn't make an effort to appeal to all Americans, and they didn't use the language of religion. What's interesting is that, so that's what happened originally. Now, by the time I wrote my book, if you go to schools of theology, most of the schools of theology are filled with women. And there is so much feminist theology. They have rewritten and rethought what the Bible means and called Jesus the greatest feminist of them all. It's a riot. But that was not the rhetoric of the early feminists, so it didn't come into the arguments that they made in the 60s, which is really too bad, because if they had, I think we would have had a very different kind of argument. They could have said Jesus is the best feminist we've ever had, and it's true. You know, what he did with Mary Magdalene is fabulous. He engaged with her in a way that no other man at that time would have ever talked with women. There's a story of women at the well. I mean, I can go on about this, but I'm not going to. On your show, you'll be happy to hear. And the same thing happened with the gay rights movement. By the time I wrote my book, the Human Rights Campaign had a theologian on their staff, whose own purpose was to reach out with a religion basis of how to read the Bible that was open to gay rights. But again, they didn't do this at the very beginning. They're catching up. Anyway, that's what's going on. And
I'm sorry, I just want to add that, you know, maybe there's hope that, first of all, That's a great explanation, because as somebody who worked for Jimmy Carter, I really didn't understand why we were always apologizing for being Christians. But also the cathedral now has John Meacham, the famous author, who's in charge of, right? He's in charge of civil engagement for the National Cathedral. So hopefully we're headed back in that direction.
It's good. Well, it's hard because there's so many secularists. I mean, the Pope has helped a lot, but COVID kept so many people out of church, which is unfortunate. And then you have the bishops in the United States who are still thinking of refusing to give Biden communion, which is completely absurd and ridiculous. I mean, over abortion, which, as I pointed out, is so interesting. The church, which is completely male in power, has decided that the one sin that is the worst is the only sin that they can't commit, which is abortion.
Right. And we've had several, correct me if I'm wrong here, Maria, but we've had young Republicans on the show who say, they want to get that out of the Republican Party.
Correct.
They understand
out of the platform.
That it's an Achilles heel for the Republicans. But then again, like I say, Kathleen, you and I are very close to the same age, and I worked on the Equal Rights Amendment when I was in college, and it still has. Still hasn't, but it still hasn't passed, my
well,
sister
I
always...
think, the truth is, there's women. I can go off on women, too. You want me to go off on women?
Yes,
sure.
The women issue. So I wrote about this, too. So I'll give you my shtick on women, okay, and why women have a problem in the United States, which is that... we've never elected a woman president is that we don't have women archetypes, female archetypes of power.
Right.
Unlike, because we're a democracy, we have never had queens. So that, for instance, in England, we've had a Queen of England, Queen Elizabeth I, who was powerful. So that if you've had royalty in your past, you've had queen, so you understand that queens could have power, but we don't have that vision. Because we are a Protestant country, our God is male. Unlike even a Catholic country like the South American countries, if you go to South America, you see Queen Mary everywhere. I mean, she's everywhere. So you've seen, Catholics really like Mary. They like Jesus too, but like Mary's a big deal. I went to, Our Lady of Victory.
Right.
So, didn't you go, Maria? Didn't you say it was like Our Lady of Lourdes or something?
Yes,
Lady
of Lourdes.
Our Lady's a big deal in the Catholic Church. So
there's
a powerful lady around, even though she's the mother of God. She's the mother of God. She's like a big deal. So they've seen a mother of God being a big deal, so they can elect a president who's a woman. But Protestants don't really pay attention to Our Lady at all. They don't pray their Hail Mary. They don't sing about Our Lady. So it's a Protestant. We're kind of a Protestant country, so they've never seen Our Lady. So, and if you think of all our holidays, there's July 4th. All the founders were male, President's Day, male, Veterans and Memorial Day, until recently, all male. And the only day we have associated with women is Mother's Day, and she's not, she's not a leader of the country, a mother. And also a lot of people have difficult relationships with the mother, too, so that's a problem, as Freud would point out.
Well, and she's not the leader of your family either, right? Your mom is the person that helps you through life.
Yeah.
Your dad is, right?
So the problem is we have never, and then, so deeper, okay, that's one problem. And then deeper than that, of course, is, our Bible has blamed all our downfall on Eve. And if you look at Thomas Aquinas, he called women misbegotten males. And there's a fourth century, I mean, obviously I'm talking about my book, but the fourth century Tertullian philosopher, which I know you had never heard of, but of course it's deep in our souls, called women the devil's gateway. So there is this really deep fear that men have of women. And it's really hard to overcome. They're right to be afraid of us, right, Maria? I mean, we are. Men really lose their power. You know, if we seduce them, like, they have nowhere to go. They are really stuck. And they don't like to lose their power.
I don't know that you got this in your career, but it was a lot, especially a woman coming up in radio, which it's mostly also a male bastion, that, there weren't very many women around to even mentor you, let alone to provide you with guidance or be the person that you wanted to be like or become. You know, Barbara Walters, yes. Connie Chung, yes. But they were almost token, I hate to say it, if you will. And I don't know, did you find that too in politics as the first female lieutenant governor of Maryland?
Right. Yeah, exactly. They're totally different today. Where 25 years ago than it is today. So different. I mean, I love reading about I wrote a review, a book review of the 2018 number of women who ran. There were so many more women and so different. Like the first article about me when I won the 2000 and as lieutenant governor, there was this huge article in the Baltimore Sun. And the first paragraph was, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, doesn't wear lipstick and didn't wear rouge.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And, of course, I did put on lipstick, and I did wear rouge, but I have dry skin, and it had faded by the time I stood up to speak, I guess. And the second article about me, as you can see, I still remember, even though it is 25 years ago, or something really long ago, maybe even 30 years ago, anyway, was... this is when I was announced to be in charge of the state police, Department of Corrections, parole and probation, juvenile justice, crime control and prevention, I wasn't wearing heels.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah. No.
Well, and we all remember them talking about Hillary Clinton's haircuts, right?
Exactly.
Nobody ever said anything about Bill Clinton's haircuts or Al Gore's haircut.
Men have a uniform and women don't have a uniform because we don't, I said, we don't have an archetype of women in power. We don't have a view of what women should look like. And so we have to create that. And we don't know what a woman in power looks like in the United States. That's really the problem.
But your daughters do. Right. Yeah. Your daughters, you've taught your daughters by example, your four daughters.
Well, that's an interesting question. If I taught them, it's hard. I'm not an archetype. An archetype is deeper than what their mother is.
Right.
Truly, that is, it really is. It has to be deep in the soul of the country. That's what I think an archetype is. It's not what their mother is. It's deeper than that. What I've learned, Maria, and I mean, this is what I've learned from my own experience, and you may have different experiences, that what your family teaches you is one thing, but what the country and the community teaches you is a very different thing. So, for instance, I grew up in a family that was interested in politics. You may have heard about that.
Yeah,
But I never occurred to me that I could run for office from them. It was only the feminist movement that taught me that I could run.
Wow.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And your family, so, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Because it was the only people who ran in my family were men. The women... you know, did charity work and raised money and had children. So it's very interesting to play between what your family teaches you and what the country teaches you. And I'll give you another example, if you don't mind. I feel like I'm dominating this conversation.
No,
well, that's
you're
what
our
we
guest.
Want.
Yes.
Okay, so when I was lieutenant governor, I had a conference on, you know, balancing family and children, family and work. And the whole conference was supposed to be about family and children, you know, work and children. And during that conference, a lot of people talked about the challenge of taking care of their older parents, not just their kids. But that's not how I had organized the conference. And yet, in my own life, I had a very supportive husband. But at that time, for most of my, you know, like for the last, at that point, 18, my oldest daughter at that point was probably 20 years old. And for the last, let's say, 19 years, he had been really good at helping me taking care of the children. But for the last year before that conference, he hadn't been that good because his mother was very sick in a nursing, you know, in a senior citizen home, and he had spent most of that last year taking care of his mother, which I have to admit was really difficult because it meant that he wasn't taking care of the children as much, and he was spending more time at the senior citizen. Did I think about that when I organized the conference? No, not at all. Did I think about my own life? No. It wasn't until I had the conference and all these other women at the conference were complaining about having to take care of their older parents that I realized, oh, that's the same problem I'm having in my own life. So it's interesting how sometimes we don't recognize what's going on in our own home until we see what's going on in the greater world. That's my two stories.
Well, and the reason I ask you about that and your daughters is I had a traditional stay-at-home mother, and she wanted me to get my bachelor's degree to get my MRS. That was the bottom line. Uh-huh. And so fast forward, I'm a single mother of four children. And I'm coaching my children in basketball, and there are 24 teams, there are 23 male coaches, and there's me. But my children never knew that. They just thought that women coach basketball because their mom coaches basketball. They didn't see the other 23 teams for some reason.
Yeah.
And I would argue that I bet your daughters, too, they see what you did. They were a part of what you did. And I would think that whether you realize it or not, that you did influence them and show them what a strong, successful mother and wife is.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yes. Well, in some sense, I think you're totally right. I will tell you a funny story about what did influence my daughter. Okay, so I had three children, and then I had an oops baby who was born 8 years after the last child. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So she was like three. She was probably 3 years old when I was lieutenant governor. So she grew up when I was in office, and she, you know, I had a lot of state troopers. You know, at that time I had a lot of protection, traveled with the state troopers all the time. So when she was she moved to Washington to go to medical school, and one night, she didn't know Washington very well, and she didn't know how the subway system worked. And so she had gone to a party, and the subway system, the metro stopped working, and she didn't have any money. So she saw a police officer, and she just asked him, would he please drive her home? Because she was accustomed to having the state troopers drive her home.
Did he drive her home?
No, he didn't. I don't think he'd never seen it. No, but he gave her money to take home.
Oh,
and then she did send him the money. You know, she found out his name and, you know, sent her money back. But I mean, it's a pretty funny story.
Very. Yeah,
and, you know, now I have to tell you a funny story about your...
I don't know if I should admit that story to anybody in Washington, but I guess I just admit it to all your listeners.
Well, you did. And I've got to tell you a story about your Uncle Ted, who I did some work for. When I first got elected, I got to go into his cubby office at the Capitol with a bunch of people, and I worked with a member of his chief of staff when I was at the DNC. I worked at the DNC for 5 years. So I mentioned that to him, and then I said, and I was just elected as a senator from the District of Columbia, and he hugged me and said, "Isn't that fun?" And I said, I thought about it later, and I said to my wife, that was the perfect answer. It acknowledged my accomplishment, but it also said, let's not forget who the real senator in the room is. And so I thought he gave me the perfect response to that. And,
oh, that's
and
great.
I was proud
that's
to have worked for him. And I got to tell you, the maybe the proudest person I ever worked for, I did a little work for Special Olympics, which is an amazing, what an amazing organization. I'm not sure that there's ever been a charity ever created that so perfectly met the need of the population for which it was created. It amazes me every time I think of how perfect
that is. That's great. Yeah.
Well, you know, we've run out of time here. Kathleen, thank you for being so generous. Is there anything you want to add? Is there a website you want to give out that people can reach out to you or anything else you want to add?
You know, I do. You know what's so funny? I didn't talk about my newest passion, but maybe another time we'll talk about that. I'm really working on, just so you know, on retirement security for all, because, you know, half of all Americans have saved nothing for retirement. And I've been working. Yes, and I have a plan on how we can solve that problem. I just can't believe I didn't get a chance to talk about that.
Well we certainly want you back. As a person that retired recently and is living off the dole of my Social Security, among other things, I was lucky enough to have my own business for 25 years, and I did invest appropriately. But I would love to have you back to talk about that sometime.
Okay. Listen, people really don't want to hear about retirement for 45 minutes, but if maybe you want me to have me on for about 10 minutes or 15 minutes to talk about that, I would really appreciate it.
Absolutely will do that. And thank you so much for being with us, and especially on this solemn day.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
You know, and we always leave our show with a song that we dedicate to our guests, and this goes out to you and the memory of your father. Here's a classic song by Dion. Thank you for listening.
Well, thank you both so much.
Thank you,
Kathleen.
Pleasure
to be with you.
Your passion is precious.
Thank you.
Yeah, you've
take
been great.
Care.
Thank you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.